Chapter 10. In a series of unusual and intricate manoeuvres, some associated with savage fighting, others the result of telephone calls from headquarters, Colonel Nitours led his troops for 3 whole days through the piled-up snowdrifts on the outskirts of the city, along the stretch from Red Tavern to Serebryanka in the south, and as far as Postvolinsky in the southwest. On the evening of the 14th of December, he brought his troops back to an alleyway in the city, to an abandoned barracks with broken glass in the windows. The troops under Nitours's command were a strange group of men. Everyone who saw them was struck by the fact that they were wearing felt boots. At the beginning of the 3 days, there had been about 150 cadets and 3 ensigns. In the first week of December, a swarthy, smooth-shaven artillery officer of medium height with melancholy eyes and wearing the epaulettes of a hussar colonel had reported to Major General Blokhin, the commander of the 1st Infantry Detachment. The newcomer introduced himself as Colonel Nitours, formerly commander of the 2nd Squadron of the Belgrade Hussars. Everyone who came across the colonel with his halting gait and fading ribbon of St. George on his threadbare military greatcoat was so struck by the sight of his melancholy eyes that they always listened to what he had to say with the greatest attention. After a short conversation with Nye, Major General Blokhin asked him to form a 2nd Infantry Detachment, requesting that it be ready for action by the 13th of December. And astonishingly, the process of forming the new detachment had been completed by the 10th of December, on which date Colonel Nitours, always economical with words, briefly told Major General Blokhin, who was beset on all sides by trilling telephones, that he, Nitours, together with his cadets, was ready to move out, but only on the understanding that all 150 of his men be supplied with felt boots and fur caps. Otherwise, any fighting would be quite out of the question. Hearing this laconic announcement delivered in Nitours's idiosyncratic Russian, Blokhin willingly wrote out the requisite order for the quartermaster's department, but warned the colonel that he would probably not obtain anything in less than a week, since the headquarters in general and the supply department in particular were in unbelievable chaos and scandalous disorder. Nitours took the requisition order, and tugging at his left moustache, as was his wont, and looking neither to the right nor to the left, ever since he had been wounded in the neck he had been unable to turn his head, needing to move his whole body whenever he wanted to look to the side, walked out of Major General Blokhin's room. On arrival at the detachment's headquarters on Lvovskaya Street, he commandeered 10 cadets, together with their rifles for no apparent reason, and 2 carts, and set off for the supply department. The supply department was situated in a most attractive little detached house on Bulvarno-Kudryavskaya Street. In a cozy little room with a map of Russia and a portrait of Alexandra Fyodorovna on the walls left over from Red Cross times, Colonel Nitours was met by Lieutenant General Makushin, a small, curiously red-faced man in a grey sheepskin sleeveless jacket with a spotlessly clean vest peeping out from under his collar, making him extraordinarily like one of Tsar Alexander II's ministers, Milyutin. Putting down the telephone receiver, the general asked Nye in a childish voice sounding like a clay whistle, "What can I do for you, Colonel?"
"My detachment wishes to deploy, and I request supply of felt boots and fur caps for 200 men immediately."
"Hmm," said the general, chewing his lips and crumpling Nye's requisition order in his hands. "You must understand, Colonel, that I am unable to supply you with these today, because we are at present making an inventory of our supplies. Please submit your request again in 3 days' time, but note that in any event I will be unable to supply the quantity you are requesting."
He placed the order in a prominent place, under a paperweight in the form of a naked woman.
"Felt boots,"
Nye repeated in a flat monotone, and his eyes narrowing, he looked down at the soles of his feet.
"What did you say?"
the general asked, staring at the colonel in astonishment.
"Felt boots at once, immediately."
"What's this? What are you saying?"
By now, the general's eyes were bulging out of their sockets. Nye turned to the door. Half opening it, he shouted out into the warm corridor,
"Platoon, to me!"
The general turned a grey shade of pale, looking from Nye's face down at the telephone receiver, then at the icon of the Virgin Mary in the corner, and then back to Nye's face. There was the sound of thudding, crashing feet in the corridor, followed by a knock on the door.
Then the black bayonets and the red bands on the flat caps of a group of Alexeyevsky cadets appeared in the doorway. The general started to get up from his soft armchair.
Never heard anything like this before in my life. This is mutiny.
Sign the requisition order, if you please, Your Excellency, Nye said. We have no time. We must leave in an hour. The enemy, they say, light by city.
What?
Rook rivalry, said Nye in a special sepulchral voice.
The general, his head sunk in his shoulders, his eyes bulging, pulled the paper out from under the naked woman, and with trembling hands and a spattering of ink, scrawled the word authorized in one corner. Nye took the piece of paper and tucked it up his sleeve.
Quickly, road the felt boots, he ordered the cadets.
With a crashing of bayonets, the cadets left the room, leaving behind their dirty footprints on the carpet. Nye, however, stayed where he was.
I will telephone headquarters, the general said, his face a shade of purple, and immediately institute proceedings to have you court-martialed. Then you'll know what's what.
Just you try, Nye answered, swallowing hard. Go on, just you try and see what happens.
He lowered his hand to the handle of his gun, peeping out from the top of his holster. The general came out in a rash, quite unable to say another word.
You pick up phone, you silly old man, and my gun shoot you in head, Nye said with sudden emotion. Then you rye on floor.
The general sat down in his chair again. His neck was purple and swollen, but his face had resumed its grey pallor. Nye turned on his heels and left the room. For several minutes, the general remained seated in his padded leather chair. Then, turning towards the icon, he crossed himself, picked up the telephone receiver, raised it to his ear, and heard the operator's muffled but familiar voice. Suddenly, the strange hussar's melancholy eyes flashed into his mind, and he replaced the receiver and looked out of the window. He saw the cadets busy carrying the grey bundles of felt boots out of the dark entrance to the warehouse. He could also see in the background the totally stunned expression on the face of the quartermaster holding the piece of paper. Nye was standing, his feet wide apart, by one of the two-wheeled carts, looking at the document. The general desultorily picked up the day's newspaper from his desk, opened it, and read the report on the first page. By the river Irpen, there have been clashes with enemy units attempting to force their way through to Sviatoshin. He tossed the newspaper back onto his desk and said out loud,
Why did I ever get involved in all this, damn it?
The door opened, and a captain, the chief quartermaster's assistant, with the appearance of a tailless ferret, entered the room. He looked expressively at the purple folds on the general's neck and said,
Permission to report, sir.
You know what, Vladimir Fyodorovich?
The general interrupted, breathing heavily, his eyes rolling wearily.
I don't feel too good. The onset of something or other. I think I'll go home now, and I would ask you if you would be so kind as to look after things in my absence.
Yes, sir,
the ferret answered, a quizzical expression on his face.
But what do you want me to do? The 4th Detachment and the Mounted Engineers are asking for felt boots. Did you agree to 200 pairs?
Yes, yes, the general replied in a high-pitched voice. Yes, I did agree to that. I agreed. My decision and my decision alone. They are to be treated as an exception, as they are about to leave for the front line. Yes.
The ferret's eyes danced with wonder and curiosity.
But we've only got 400 pairs in total.
What can I do about it? What?
Shouted the general hoarsely.
Give birth to some more? Give birth? Is that it? If they ask for boots, then give them to them. Give them to them.
5 minutes later, General Makushin was driven home in a cab. On the night of the 13th to the 14th of December, the barracks on Brest-Litovskaya Alley came to life. In the vast, dirty hall, the electric lights on the walls between the windows came on again. The cadets had spent the day suspended on lampposts, connecting various wires. 150 rifles stood on trestles, and the cadets slept side by side on dirty plank beds. Naitours sat at a rickety wooden table, piled with hunks of bread, pots of some sort of congealed liquid, cartridge pouches and cartridge clips, with a multicoloured map of the city spread out in front of him. A small domestic lamp threw a patch of light onto the map, showing the river Dnieper in blue, branching out like a tree. At about 2 o'clock that morning, Nye started to be overcome by sleep. He leant forward several times, sniffing at the map, as if trying to discern something more closely. Then he called out quietly,
"Cadet?"
"Yes, Colonel, sir,"
came the response from the door, and a cadet came up to the lamp, his felt boots swishing.
"I'm going to ride down now," said Nye. "Wake me in 3 hours. If there is a telephone message, wake Ensign Jarlov, and he must wake me or not, depending on what the message says."
But there was no telephone message. Indeed, Nye's detachment remained generally undisturbed that night. The next morning, at dawn, the detachment set off with 3 machine guns and 3 two-wheeled carts, spreading out along the road. The little houses on the outskirts of the city seemed devoid of life, but when they emerged onto the broad stretch of Polytechnic Street, they came across a lot of activity. In the early light of dawn, they caught a glimpse of baggage wagons rattling past them, and of the grey fur caps of troops trudging along. Everything and everybody was heading back into the city, looking a little fearfully at Nye's men as they went by. As it slowly but surely became lighter, the mist hanging over the gardens of the official government dachas and the rutted and potholed road began to lift and disperse. That day, Nye's detachment stayed in the area of Polytechnic Street until 3 o'clock. A cadet from his signals unit had ridden up on a 4th two-wheeled cart with the following penciled note from headquarters. "Maintain defense of Polytechnic Street. Engage enemy on site." Nye Tours first saw this enemy at 3 o'clock, with the appearance of numerous mounted troops way over to his left on the snow-covered parade ground of a military barracks. These were Kozia Lieshka's men attempting to come out onto the main road, along which they could penetrate into the heart of the city, in accordance with Colonel Tarapietz's plan. In actual fact, right up to the Polytechnic Street area, Kozia Lieshka had not encountered any resistance at all. He was not so much attacking the city as simply entering it in a broad, triumphant sweep, knowing full well that he was being followed by Colonel Soznenko's regiment of Ukrainian Cossack cavalry, 2 regiments from the Blue Division, a regiment of riflemen from the south, and 6 gun batteries. As soon as the distant dots of horsemen appeared on the parade ground, shrapnel started bursting high in the heavy snow-laden sky, like a flock of cranes. The horsemen formed into a single line that darkened and swelled as they galloped towards Nye Tours. All along the lines of cadets, the snap of rifle bolts could be heard. Nye Tours took out his whistle, gave a piercing whistle, and shouted, "Take aim at cavalry ahead! Lapid fire!" Flashes sparked along the grey lines of cadets as they fired their opening shots at Kozia. Then the sky resounded 3 times as shells hurtled as far as the walls of the Polytechnic, and 3 times Nye Tours' men responded with a thunderous roar. The dark line of horsemen broke up, scattered and disappeared from the road. Meanwhile, a change had been taking place in Nye Tours. Although, as a matter of fact, no one in the detachment had ever seen Nye Tours to be afraid of anything, now it seemed to the cadets that he had become aware of danger. Maybe in the sky, or maybe he'd heard something in the distance. In short, whatever it was, Nye gave the order to retreat back to the city. 1 unit remained, firing deafeningly along the road to cover the others. Then this too started to run back. They ran for about 1 mile, stumbling along, their boots thudding on the road, until they came to the crossroads marking the intersection with the same Brest-Litovsk alley where they had spent the previous night. The crossing was completely dead, and there wasn't another person in sight. Here, Nye singled out 3 cadets.
"At the double, to Porovaya and Bogschakovskaya streets," he ordered the cadets, "and find out where our troops are and what they're doing. If you come across any baggage wagons, carts, or any other means of transport retreating in a disorganized way, seize them. If you meet with resistance, threaten them with weapons, and then, if necessary, shoot them."
The cadets disappeared at 1 run back to the left. Suddenly, they came under fire from somewhere in front. The bullets ricocheted off the walls, and the shooting intensified. 1 cadet collapsed face down on the snow, reddening it with his blood. He was followed by another cadet, who slumped back from his machine gun with a groan. As Nye's men spread out, they poured a rapid, constant hail of fire onto the shadowy groups of the enemy, who seemed to rise out of the ground as if by magic. The wounded cadets were picked up and bandaged. Knots seemed to have formed in Nye's cheekbones. He turned his body more and more often, trying to see what was happening far out on either flank. It was evident, just from the expression on his face, that he was waiting impatiently for the three cadets he had sent off into the city. Finally, they arrived at a run, panting like hounds on the chase, breathing with a hoarse whistle. Nye drew himself up, his face darkening. The first cadet ran up to him and stood there in front of him, gasping for breath.
"Colonel, there was no sign of any of our troops, not only on Shulyavka, but anywhere at all,"
the cadet said, catching his breath.
"We heard machine gun fire to our rear, and the enemy cavalry is now moving along from the far end of Shulyavka, apparently entering the city."
At that instant, the cadet's words were drowned out by Nye's deafening whistle. The three carts rumbled into Brest-Litovsk Alley, then clattered along it, and from there down Fonani, rolling and swaying in the potholes. The carts were fully loaded with the two wounded cadets, 15 other armed and able-bodied men, and all three machine guns. Nye Tours turned to face his lines of men, and, in his idiosyncratic accent, gave the cadets a strange order they had never heard before in their lives. Meanwhile, the 28 cadets in the third section of the 1st Infantry Detachment were idling away their time in the somewhat dilapidated but well-heated building of the former army barracks on Lvovskaya Street. The most interesting point about this inactivity was that the cadets' commander was none other than Nikolka Turbin. The detachment's commander, Staff Captain Bezrukov, together with two of his officers, both ensigns, had left that morning to go to headquarters, but had not returned. Nikolka, the most senior lance corporal present, was loafing about, now and again going up to look at the telephone. This situation lasted until 3 o'clock. By now, the cadets all had rather bleak expressions. Then, at 3 o'clock, the telephone rang.
"Is that the third section?"
"Yes."
"Put the commander on the telephone."
"Who's speaking?"
"This is headquarters."
"The commander has not returned."
"And who are you?"
"Lance Corporal Turbin."
"Are you the senior person there?"
"Yes, I am."
"Take your men and start implementing the plan."
And Nikolka took his 28 men and led them along the street. Alexei Vasilievich Turbin slept the sleep of the dead right through to 2 o'clock in the afternoon. He woke up suddenly as if someone had doused him with water, glanced at the little clock on his bedside chair, saw that it was 10 to 2, and started to rush about the room. He tugged on his felt boots and began stuffing things into his pockets, in his haste forgetting first one thing, then another, matches, cigarette case, handkerchief, Browning, and 2 cartridge clips, and tightened the belt on his greatcoat. Then he remembered something else, something that seemed to him to be both shameful and cowardly. Nonetheless, after a moment's hesitation, he went to his desk and took out his civilian doctor's passport. But as he was turning it over in his hands, deciding whether or not to take it, he heard Yelena calling out to him, and he put the passport down on the table and forgot about it.
"Listen, Yelena," Turbin said, tugging nervously at his belt. He had a nagging premonition of impending disaster, and he was distinctly unhappy at the thought that Yelena and Anyuta would be remaining alone in the large, empty apartment. "It can't be helped. I have to go. I don't suppose anything will happen to me. The battalion will not be going any farther than the outskirts of the city, and I will be somewhere or other that's safe. And let's pray that God will keep Nikolka safe, too. I heard this morning that the situation has worsened a little. But let's hope we'll beat off Petliura. Goodbye. Goodbye."
When he'd gone, Yelena walked about the empty sitting room, from the piano with its colourful Faust music still standing open, to the door to Alexei's study, and back again. The parquet floor creaked under her feet. She looked very sad. Standing on the corner of Vladimirskaya Street and his own winding street, Turbin hailed a cab. Sighing gloomily, the cabbie agreed to take him, but only after naming a monstrously inflated price, making it clear he wasn't going to back down. Gritting his teeth, Turbin got into the sleigh, and they set off in the direction of the museum. There was frost everywhere. Alexei felt deeply anxious. As they travelled along, he could hear distant bursts of machine gun fire coming from the direction of the Polytechnic. It sounded as if they were firing at the railway station. Turbin wondered what this might signify. He had slept through Bolbotun's midday incursion into the city. He turned to look at the pavements. Although there was a sense of confusion and anxiety, there were still quite a few people about.
Stop! Stop!
Shouted an inebriated voice. What's the meaning of this? Turbin asked angrily. The cabbie pulled back on the reins with such force that Turbin was almost thrown onto his knees. An extremely red face could be seen swaying by the shaft, clinging onto the reins and trying to clamber along them to get to the driver's seat. The crumpled epaulettes of an ensign gleamed on his short, tanned coat. From only a couple of feet away, Turbin was almost overcome by the powerful reek of onion and illicit vodka. The ensign was holding a rifle in his unsteady hands.
Turn around, said the red-faced drunkard. Tell your passenger to get off.
The word passenger suddenly struck him as funny, and he giggled.
What's the meaning of this? Turbin repeated angrily. Can't you see who I am? I'm on my way to report for duty. Please let go of the driver. Carry on. No, you stay there, said the red-faced man menacingly.
But then, suddenly, he blinked as he noticed Turbin's epaulettes.
A doctor. I see. In that case, I'll come with you. We aren't going your way. Carry on, driver. Just a moment. Carry on.
The cabbie, his head sunk into his shoulders, made as if to tug at the reins, but changed his mind and gave the red-faced man a look that was both fearful and dark with anger. But the latter had moved away, his attention caught by the sight of an empty cab. As the empty cab tried unsuccessfully to move off, the man raised his rifle in both hands and threatened the cabbie. The cabbie froze on the spot, and the drunkard shambled towards him, stumbling and hiccuping.
I knew I shouldn't have agreed to take you, even for 500.
Turbin's cabbie grumbled angrily, whipping his horse.
If I get shot in the back, where does that get me?
Turbin maintained a gloomy silence.
What a swine, he thought angrily. It's people like him who bring shame on the whole enterprise.
The crossroads by the opera house were seething with bustle and activity. Two cadets were standing in the middle of a tramline guarding a machine gun. One of them was short and obviously frozen, with earmuffs and wearing a black greatcoat. The other was in grey uniform. Crowds of passers-by had gathered in little groups on the pavements like flies, looking with curiosity at the machine gun. At the chemist's on the corner, with the museum in sight, Turbin stopped the cab and paid the driver.
I need more than that, Your Honour, the cabbie insisted grimly. If I had known, I wouldn't have agreed to take you. Look what's going on.
No, that's all you're getting.
Why have they dragged children into this?
Said a woman standing nearby. Only then did Turbin notice a large group of armed soldiers by the museum, swaying and growing in size. In among the folds of the greatcoats on the pavement, he could dimly make out a number of machine guns. At that moment, there was the furious rattle of a machine gun from the direction of Pechersk.
What nonsense is this now? Wondered Turbin in confusion, and quickening his pace, he crossed the road, making for the museum. I'm not late, am I? What a disgrace. They might think I've made off somewhere.
Crowds of ensigns and cadets, together with a few soldiers, were dashing around excitedly by the entrance to the museum and the broken side gates leading to the Alexandrovsky High School parade ground. The enormous glass windows in the doors shuddered, and the doors groaned as the armed, disheveled, and excited cadets rushed into the circular white museum building with its pediment boasting the following inscription in gold letters, For the Enlightenment of the Russian People.
Oh my God! Shouted Turbin involuntarily. They've already gone!
Standing lonely and abandoned, exactly where they had been the day before, the mortars gaped silently at Turbin.
I don't understand a thing. What does it mean?
Without knowing why, Turbin started running across the parade ground towards the mortars. They grew bigger as he approached, looking more and more threatening. And then, suddenly, he noticed the mortar on the end. He stopped, frozen to the spot. Its breech mechanism was missing. He raced back across the parade ground and out again onto the street. Here, the crowd had got even bigger. Many people were shouting, and bayonets could be seen poking up above people's heads.
We have to wait for Kartuzov. That's what we must do, boomed someone anxiously.
An ensign walked in front of Turbin, carrying a yellow saddle with dangling stirrups.
It's for the Polish Legion.
Yes, but where is it?
God knows. Everyone into the museum. Come on, into the museum. To the Don!
The ensign suddenly stopped and threw the saddle down on the pavement.
How to hell with it! They can all rot for all I care, he shouted furiously. Those bloody staff officers!
What a catastrophe. Now I understand. That's awful. They must have gone into battle as infantry.
Yes, yes, that must be it.
Petliura must have got here quicker than expected. There weren't any horses, so they set off with just their rifles without the mortars. Oh my God, I must get to Madame Anjou's quickly. Maybe I'll find out what's going on once I'm there. Surely there'll still be someone there, won't there?
Turbin slipped out of all the confusion and ran back towards the opera theatre, ignoring everything around him. A dry gust of wind blew along the asphalt path around the theatre, ruffling the edge of a half-torn poster on the wall of the theatre by the darkened windows of the side entrance. Carmen. Carmen. At last, he was at Madame Anjou's. The cannon and the gold epaulettes in the window had gone. A glowing light flickered fitfully in the windows. Was the place on fire? Turbin tried to push open the door. It jangled a little, but didn't open. He knocked cautiously. He knocked again. A dim, grey figure appeared momentarily behind the glass door, opened it, and Turbin went inside. Dumbfounded, he stared at the strange figure who was wearing a student's black greatcoat and a moth-eaten civilian cap with ear flaps pulled down over the crown of his head. The stranger's face seemed somehow familiar, but there was something weirdly disfigured about it. The stove was roaring away, consuming sheets of paper. The floor was littered with paper. After letting Turbin in, the stranger darted to the stove without saying a word and squatted down, the red glow from the fire playing on his face.
Is it Malyshev?
Yes, it is, Colonel Malyshev, Turbin said to himself, recognizing who it was. The colonel had lost his moustache. His upper lip was now blue and clean-shaven. His hands spread out wide, Malyshev scooped up sheets of paper from the floor and put them on the fire.
Aha, thought Turbin.
What's happening? It's all over, isn't it? He asked dully.
Yes, it's all over, the colonel replied laconically.
He jumped up and went quickly over to his desk, gave it a searching look, and banged the drawers a few times, pulling them out and putting them back. Then he suddenly bent down, picked up the last lot of sheets of paper from the floor, and stuffed them into the stove. Only then did he turn to Turbin and say calmly and ironically,
Well, we've done our bit of fighting. Enough.
He reached inside his coat and hastily pulled out his wallet, examining the documents inside. He then took two of them out, tore them in half, and tossed them into the stove. All this time, Turbin was staring at him. This wasn't the Colonel Malyshev that he knew at all. Instead, he saw in front of him the figure of a rather sturdy student, an amateur actor with puffy, pinkish-red lips.
Doctor, what are you thinking of?
Malyshev said with a worried tone, pointing at Turbin's epaulettes.
Take them off at once. What are you doing here? Where have you come from? Don't you know anything?
I was late, Colonel, Turbin began to explain. Malyshev gave him a cheerful grin. Then the smile suddenly disappeared, and he shook his head with an apologetic and anxious expression on his face.
Oh, my God. I was the one who put you in this spot. I was the one who told you to be back at this time. You've been at home all day, haven't you? Well, all right, let's not talk about that now. Let's just say you need to remove your epaulettes immediately, then run off and hide somewhere.
Yes, but tell me what's going on, for goodness sake.
What's going on? Echoed Malyshev with an ironic laugh. What's going on is that Petliura's already in the city, in Pyacersk, if not already on the Kreschatyk. The city's been taken.
Malyshev suddenly grinned again, looking to one side. Then, again unexpectedly, he started talking as if he were the old Malyshev and not some amateur actor.
Headquarters have betrayed us,
We should have dispersed as long ago as this morning, but luckily, thanks to some good people, I was told all about it last night and managed to disband the battalion. Doctor, we haven't got time to waste. Take those epaulettes off.
But the museum, back there at the museum.
Malyshev's face darkened.
Nothing to do with me, he answered furiously. Not my problem. Nothing's my problem anymore. I was there not long ago, shouting and warning people to disperse. I can't do any more now. I've saved all my own men. I haven't sent them to be slaughtered, and I have saved them from a shameful fate.
Malyshev suddenly began shouting hysterically. Clearly, something had been coming to the boil inside him, which could not be suppressed any longer.
Those damned generals!
He yelled, clenching his fists and making a threatening gesture. His face had gone purple. From somewhere farther up the street came the crackle of machine gun fire, and it seemed as if the large house next door was being hit. Malyshev gave a start and fell silent.
Right, Doctor, get going. Goodbye, just run, but not out into the street. Go out the back way and then through the courtyards. That way's still open. Quickly!
He shook the stunned Turbin's hand, turned sharply on his heels, and ran off through the dark gap behind the partitions. Immediately, everything went quiet in the shop. Outside, the machine gun had stopped firing. Now he was alone. The paper in the stove was still alight. Turbin made his way to the door, slowly and listlessly, despite Malyshev's exhortations to hurry. He fumbled for the latch and dropped it into the loop. Ignoring what Malyshev had said, he took his time over everything he did, moving around on sluggish legs, his mind blurred and apathetic. The paper in the fire was burning out, and the stove's cheerful flames had now become a dull red glow. Immediately, the shop went much darker. In the grey shadows, the shelves clung to the walls. Turbin ran his eyes over them, dimly conscious that Madame Anjou's still smelt of perfume, faintly maybe, but the scent was still definitely there. Turbin's thoughts were milling around in total confusion, and he spent some time in pointless contemplation of the place where the smooth-shaven colonel had disappeared. Then, in the silence, the knot in his brain slowly unraveled, and the most important thread became transparently clear. Petlura was here.
Petura, Petura, he repeated dully, grinning for no particular reason.
He went up to the mirror that was hanging on the wall between the windows. It was covered with a layer of dust, like muslin. The paper had now all been used up, and the final little red tongue of fire flickered for a moment longer on the floor, and then went out. Everything went dark.
Petlura, how ridiculous it all is. The country's now essentially a hopeless cause, Turbin muttered in the darkness.
Then he suddenly remembered where he was.
What am I standing here dreaming for? They could be here any minute.
Then, just like Malyshev immediately before his departure, he hurriedly ripped off his epaulettes. The threads made a crackling sound as they came away, and he found himself holding two tarnished silver stripes from his tunic and two green ones from his greatcoat. He looked at them, turning them in his hands and wanting to tuck them away in his pockets as a keepsake. But realizing that this was dangerous, he changed his mind and decided to burn them. There was no lack of combustible material, even though Malyshev had burnt every single document. He scooped up an armful of silk scraps from the floor, stuffed them in the stove, and set them alight. Once again, distorted shadows played on the walls and the floor as Madame Anjou's establishment temporarily came to life. The silver stripes warped and buckled in the flames, bubbling as they swelled up, then turned black and shriveled into nothing. At that point, a really serious thought occurred to Turbin. What should he do with the door? Leave it on the latch or not? What if one of the volunteers who had been left behind just like him should come running here looking for shelter? There wouldn't be anywhere to hide otherwise. He unfastened the latch. Then another thought seared through his brain. What about his passport? He clutched at one pocket, then another. Nothing there. So that was it, damn it. He'd left it behind at home. That was awful. What if he were to bump into some of them? He would be wearing a grey greatcoat, and they would ask who he was.
Aha, a doctor, you say? Prove it.
How stupidly absent-minded of him. Come on, get a move on, a voice whispered inside him.
Wasting no more time thinking, Turbin dashed through into the depths of the shop, and taking the same way out as Malyshev, ran out of the small door into a dark corridor, and from there into the yard at the back.